Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. This week we celebrate President's Day, once two separate holidays, Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday, and actually celebrated on the dates of their birth. What a concept. But we have what we have, and it's history, which is interesting, will be the topic of our conversation this week with Matthew Dennis. After that, Talking History's Fiona Beatty and another of her Sites of the Week will tell us where we can learn more about the American presidency, and Ray Gesselbrock will fill us in on a favorite pastime of President Harry Truman. But first, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news on this President's Day. The subject of Abraham Lincoln's sexuality has long been debated among scholars. They cite his troubled marriage to Mary Todd and his youthful friendship with Joshua Speed, who shared his bed for 4 years. Now, in a new book on the subject, C.A. Tripp lends his support to the theory. In The Intimate World of Abraham Lincoln, published by Free Press, Tripp, a psychologist and former sex researcher for Alfred Kinsey, who died 2 weeks after finishing the book, cites, among other things, Lincoln's extreme privacy and accounts by those who knew him well. "He was not very fond of girls, it seems to me," his stepmother Sarah Bush Lincoln told Lincoln's law partner William Herndon. And Tripp adds, "he was terrified of the prospect of marrying Mary Todd, leading him to break off the relationship once before they finally did marry and have 4 children. Tripp's book has neither stopped the debate nor gone unchallenged. David Donald, who is considered the definitive biographer of Lincoln, disagrees with Tripp. Last year, in his book We Are Lincoln Men, Donald mentioned Tripp's research and disputed his findings. He wrote that the correspondence between Speed and Lincoln was not that of lovers, that no one at the time ever suggested that Lincoln and Speed were sexual partners, and that Herndon, who sometimes slept in the same room with them, never mentioned a sexual relationship. In Frontier Times, Donald added, space was tight and men shared beds, and Lincoln openly admitted to the arrangement, something, Donald believes, Lincoln would not have so publicly and freely admitted if the two were lovers. And the National Archives and Records Administration has released additional materials relating to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Under the John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992, the Assassination Records Review Board determined that certain records should be released incrementally over the next several years, through 2010. As a result, over 40,000 documents that have not been made public or that have been released in edited form only will be made available in full. Yet to come, Matthew Dennis and I discuss President's Day, Fiona Beatty tells us about a related museum exhibit and website, and Ray Gesselbrock tells us about Harry Truman, the poker player. You're listening to Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History for another in our year-long series on American holidays, Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar, published by Cornell University Press. Last month, Matthew and I talked about Martin Luther King Day. This week, we look at President's Day. Welcome back, Matt.
Good to be here.
Okay. Let's begin by having you remind our listeners why you think civic holidays are so important.
Well, I think there are moments when Americans are forced, or allowed anyway, to reflect on who they are. And we see, you know, this, what sometimes is celebrated in terms of leisure, at least has the possibility to provoke some reflection about American culture, about American identity, about the nature of American history. And it's a place where popular historical consciousness is kind of provoked and shaped. Key moments of history are revisited, at least in some fashion, and Americans can reassess the sorts of values that make them who they are, that represent their best hopes and dreams. There are opportunities when people can critique Americans for failing to live up to those dreams, and sometimes push for reform. Even when they're celebrated with leisure and consumption, at least there's that kind of latent possibility for some kind of real engagement and potential change in American life.
Okay, fair enough. Now, last month you described Martin Luther King Day as protean and a work in progress. You described President's Day as unheroic as it gets, a time for forgetting, not remembering, an anti-memorial movement. Before they lynch you up, you better explain that. Are you disparaging the presidents? What point are you trying to make here?
No, I'm not. I'm really trying to reflect on what seems to be the emergence of a post-heroic age that we live in. We have these great American heroes, and I think, you know, Americans acknowledge them, Washington and Lincoln in particular. But, you know, what's happened to those, great stars in the American political universe? They seem to have tarnished a bit. Maybe it's too much to ask for Americans to retain these heroes as vital in their own lives when so much has changed. And so what we see then with President's Day, though, is a kind of delusion. It's a picture where you have maybe Washington and Lincoln, but you have all these other much less impressive, mediocre presidents almost crowding them out of the picture, obscuring their view. You know, I don't think we're really, in President's Day, we don't really celebrate all presidents, even though it seems to be the way it's defined now. We're really celebrating the two greatest presidents in American history, Washington and Lincoln, and yet their visages have been obscured on Mount Rushmore, and we don't see them as clearly as we might.
No, good point. Okay, well, in your book, you resist that and really stay pretty much focused on the rise of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln as heroes and the creation of national holidays dedicated to them. So let's take the same approach. Tell us about the origins and development of Washington's birthday.
Well, Washington emerged as the father of his country before his country even officially existed. He was a kind of totemic figure in a way. I mean, he was the symbol that physically embodied the American nation. He was appointed to be commander-in-chief in 1775 by Congress. And, you know, there wasn't, at least officially, in the United States yet. It hadn't declared its independence officially. And Washington was able to, you know, kind of represent what that American nationhood from the very beginning. During the war itself, his birthday began to be celebrated. As Americans celebrated Washington, they were really celebrating themselves, in a way celebrating themselves into existence as the United States. So we see that emerge right away in the Revolution and in the immediate aftermath. And then, you know, in some ways, unlike some famous generals, he had a fairly successful post-military career and set the precedent for the American presidency, and he became a beloved figure, really a kind of sacred figure, so that he went beyond, even though different political parties would try to adopt him, he became a kind of bipartisan but even nonpartisan figure. And if one could associate one's cause or oneself with Washington, it gave it a kind of power that it couldn't otherwise have. And so we see emerging in the 19th century Washington advocating for, posthumously of course, all sorts of causes that one, you know, wouldn't imagine. But he became a symbol for Americans and represented everything imaginable that was good in American life. So Washington continued to represent that all the way through the Civil War, so that even by the time of the Civil War, both North and South could embrace him as their legitimate hero and political ancestor. Washington, for example, was on the Confederate seal. Jefferson Davis had himself inaugurated on Washington's birthday in Richmond. Meanwhile, of course, the North and those who were trying to preserve the Union couldn't have found a better symbol than Washington himself, who was among the most important figures, probably the preeminent one, in actually creating that union in the first place.
So both sides are trying to claim some lineage here. It's almost a primitivist movement to have some origins in an earlier period.
Absolutely.
Okay. What about the origins of Lincoln's birthday?
Well, Lincoln emerges as a perfect complement to Washington. If Washington created the Union, Lincoln preserved it. Lincoln becomes, you know, almost a kind of messianic figure, really. He's assassinated on Good Friday in 1865 and becomes a martyr for the Union he worked so hard to preserve. And so, unlike Washington, his appeal certainly is more regionally circumscribed. In the South, it was only really African Americans who embraced him as a hero. Yet, Lincoln still could represent North and parts of the South. He was born in the South and migrated out to the West, to Illinois. And so he kind of represented North, South, and West. He was a great commoner. He kind of balances Washington's aristocratic birth. And he represented, you know, equality and liberation and preservation of the Union. And this really echoed the reputation of Washington as well, who during the early 19th century was seen as a hero of the anti-slavery movement, because the actual history of this is much more complicated, but he had certainly had the reputation of being an anti-slavery advocate based on his freeing of his own slaves in his will.
Well, as you're suggesting here, what really happens very soon is that the two become paired, or even some people refer to them as the Peter and Paul of American popular culture. How did this happen? And you've alluded to in some part already how this came about, but develop it further. How did they end up being paired?
Well, as I said, one was the father of his country, the other was the preserver of his country. And so it was a kind of a continuation of that great heroic presence in many ways, a kind of updating and modernizing of what the hero would have to supply in the 19th century, dealing with the new issues that faced America, especially the threat to the Union. They're a kind of a divine dyad. And so, in a way, then Lincoln updated and reformed what Washington represented. He was a representative of the common man. He represented the expansion of the nation all the way to the West Coast and places in between. It's no coincidence that he would give his name to places like Lincoln, Nebraska, just as George Washington would name the state on the upper left corner of the map. So what we see then is Lincoln being very much seen as a complement and extension of Washington, a new kind of Republican hero, small r and capital R Republican, and representing democracy, equality, liberty, and the Union, just as Washington had been. I mean, there are certainly tensions in this, and you would see with Lincoln, just as with Washington, the attempt to associate him with all sorts of different causes, some more plausibly than others. By the very end of the 19th century, Washington would end up being resurrected as a hero for American elite organizations based on heredity. You see the emergence at that point of organizations like the Daughters of the American Republic and other kind of lineage-based organizations. Washington, the 100th anniversary of his inauguration, was celebrated in 1889, and it was an effort to restore, in the view of some, a greater order and commitment to authority in American life at a time when some were very concerned about labor agitation and the influx of immigrants and rampant industrialization and all these things. Throughout that time, Lincoln remained a kind of common man hero and was more apt to be the hero of organized labor, for example. And so in a way, they were kind of a good 1-2 punch and really retained their heroic stature and importance in American life through that period into the, well into the 20th century.
Okay, and just to build on that a bit, I think you make a very good point by saying all these causes and ideals that you've already identified really were made concrete and maybe even more persuasive through their embodiment in the figures of Washington and Lincoln. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, because some of these things are quite abstract. I mean, what does equality mean? Well, you know, it has physical implications, and the advocates for it are, when you can, you know, look at Lincoln, you know, we're able to understand that better. Or when you talked about union, what did union mean and what were the sacrifices one had to make? Washington and then Lincoln could represent that in their physical presence. And then, you know, we even see that reflected in some of the commercialization of those figures. I mean, something, say, like Lincoln Logs that I played with as a kid, you know, were sturdy and basic American things. You're building something solid. Or maybe more implausibly, Lincoln's name was used to designate a positively presidential vehicle, the Lincoln Continental. And, you know, here, I mean, that's pushing it a bit to have Lincoln, the man of the people, symbolize this, you know, more prestigious automobile. But that was the idea, that somehow the name of Lincoln or the name of Washington could embody in a physical way the sorts of values that Americans thought were important.
Okay. Let's wrap it up by just asking you, so when did President's Day come along? And it seems like you think it was a mistake.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's up to me to decide, you know, or judge whether it's a mistake or not.
Sure, you can do that.
What we see, you know, by the end of the 1960s, 1968, Congress passed the Monday Holiday Act, and it was meant to kind of rationalize the American calendar. And so what we see is the creation of these various holidays as movable three-day feasts, culminating on the Monday designated as, in this case, President's Day. February, it can be a grim month in a lot of parts of the country, and Americans maybe need some holidays as a kind of, you know, therapy. So we have Valentine's Day, which brightens things up, but we also had Lincoln's birthday and Washington's birthday on the 12th and 22nd. In order to rationalize this, these architects of the American calendar decided that they could lump them together, call them generically a President's Day, and put it on the third Monday in February. I think what it did was not so much prescribe what should happen to these presidents, but really described a kind of dimming of their reputations. And so it kind of consolidated this into one generic holiday, which has, you know, much less meaning than it might. But I think even here, there's, you know, laying weight is the potential for these heroes' reputations to be revisited, reexamined, and maybe to become inspiring again.
Okay, well put, and that's where we'll leave it. Thank you, Matt, for joining us. We'll look forward to speaking with you again. I guess it'll be in May this time, about Memorial Day.
Okay, great.
You've been listening to Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, an American Calendar, published by Cornell University Press. This is Talking History. As you just heard, the history of President's Day is interesting, but so too, of course, are the stories of the men who occupied that office and of the presidency itself. Talking History's Fiona Beattie is here to tell you where you can learn more about those stories.
Every artifact tells a story, and the artifacts included in the Smithsonian's exhibition, The American Presidency, A Glorious Burden, have been chosen to enhance that story. It's a collective history of the presidents and the presidency, and among other things, it allows visitors to glimpse at how presidents have reacted to the demands of presidency and how they were defined by the office. The travelling component of the exhibition began its tour in 2002 and is booked through 2006. A permanent exhibit at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. has over 900 artifacts, many interactive components, films, and lectures. For the virtual visitor, the Smithsonian offers an in-depth tour, beginning with the foundations of the presidency, where the visitor learns how the presidency is defined and the limitations of presidency. One section, called Life and Death in the White House, details its history and stories of its occupants throughout the years. In another section, Communicating the Presidency, the media relations between the president and the American public is cleverly addressed by juxtaposing it with the public perception and opinion of the president as expressed in the media. And there's more. The site is well worth a visit. This is an HTTP address, americanhistory.si.edu/presidency.
Thank you, Fiona. And if you're into losers rather than winners, visit the Gallery of Also-Rans in Norton, Kansas. Norton is a town of only about 3,000 people in the northwestern part of Kansas, but it's proud to have the only private gallery of presidential losers in the country, in the mezzanine of Norton's First State Bank. It was the brainstorm of the late W.W. Rouse, who conceived of the idea after reading a book about failed presidential candidates, and it draws about 75 visitors a year, notes curator Diana McGee, who is also the bank's secretary and receptionist. I think some people think it's a joke. But it really isn't, McGee explained. Bill Rouse was really interested in history, and he really thought that this was an honor, that anyone who ran for president was pretty important. The first loser whose portrait appears in the gallery is that of Thomas Jefferson, who lost in the election of 1796. John Kerry's is yet to be added. This is Talking History.
Born to lose, I've lived my life in vain. Every dream has only brought me pain. All my life, I've always been so blue. Born to lose, and now I'm losing you. Born to lose, it seems so hard to bear.
And finally, as promised, Ray Gesselbrock joins us to tell us about the favorite pastime of another of America's presidents. The pastime is poker, and the president is Harry S. Truman. Gesselbrock is an archivist and special assistant to the director of the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library.
When Harry Truman was asked in 1955 what he did to relax, he responded, "Well, my only relaxation is to work." This was no doubt almost true, but Truman forgot to mention something he loved to do, something that took some time, demanded close attention, consumed a certain amount of emotional energy, and must have caused him anxiety from time to time. Truman forgot to mention that, for relaxation and to enjoy the company of friends, he loved to play poker. The first documentation of Truman's love of card playing, not specifically poker, is in a 1911 letter to Bess Wallace. He almost certainly played poker during World War I. After the war, when he became county judge for Jackson County, Missouri, he was a founding member of a poker club called the Harpy Club. He probably played regularly with the club members at least until he became a United States Senator in 1935. He also played during the same time with his Army Reserve buddies during summer encampments. After he became president, his favorite poker venue was the yacht Williamsburg. Winston Churchill joined Truman and his cronies for an especially memorable game on May 5, 1946. They were on the train on their way to Fulton, Missouri, where Churchill would deliver his famous Iron Curtain speech. Churchill was boasting that he had been playing poker since the Boer War, and Truman was worried that the Briton might embarrass the Americans. But as the game got underway, it became clear that Churchill was in fact quite an inept player, and he lost steadily. When he left the room for a moment, Truman told the other players that maybe they'd have to ease up a little on Churchill. One of the players, Truman's military aide, Harry Vaughan, responded, "Boss, this guy's a pigeon. If you want us to play our best poker for the nation's honor, we'll have this guy's pants before the evening is over." The Americans did ease up some, but not enough to let the Briton go away saying he'd won. After he left office, Truman played poker with different groups of friends in Kansas City and Independence. The games involved enough money to make them serious, but their purpose was always social, and their mood lighthearted. Truman himself was not always a very good player. His main fault was that he never wanted to drop out of a hand. He made up for this deficiency, though, at least in his later years, by playing a game called Vincent when he was the dealer. This game was devised by one of his favorite poker buddies during his presidential years, Chief Justice of the United States, Fred Vinson. One witness of a game of Vinson remembered it this way. "It's low ball, high ball. I never did understand. Truman was pretty good at it because nobody else understood what we were doing. So every time we played Vinson, he would win. It was dealer's choice. So Mr. Truman, about every time he was dealer, he'd say, 'Well, we're going to play Vinson now.'" Once in 1946, when Truman was looking forward to a poker outing on the Williamsburg, he wrote a letter to Bess to tell her how he felt about the games in prospect. "You know," he wrote, "I'm almost like a kid. I can hardly wait to start." It was never any different for Harry Truman, the poker player.
You've been listening to Ray Gesselbrock, archivist and special assistant to the director of the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library. That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guest on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.